Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. Our guest today is Simon Bell. Simon is a retired mental health nurse who spent 37 years working in the National Health Service in the UK. For 22 years, he dealt solely with suspects, defendants and offenders from the time of their arrest until the point when criminal proceedings took place. He dealt with most types of offending behaviour and over the course of his career was involved in assessing and caring for several thousand offenders and victims of crime. His passion for history goes back to childhood. His passion for the Holocaust has its origins in being involved with the care of survivors of Nazi brutality whom he met during his early days in mental health care. He's the author of Auschwitz-Birkenau, From Hell to Hope, and Tribalism and Prejudice, The Far Right and Lessons from History, which will be the topic of our discussion today. Well, hello, Simon. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Okay, well, Simon, could you perhaps begin by telling us a little bit about your background and how you became interested in this topic?
Yeah, I mean, you've alluded to some of it already with the introduction, but if I can elaborate on that, I had a 37-year nursing career. Yeah. So I started off as a general nurse very briefly, and then I worked in mental health care for 35 years. And for 22 years, as you've already mentioned, I dealt solely with the offender population from the time they're arrested through to criminal proceedings being concluded. The early part of my mental health career was actually in old institutional care, asylum care, that we don't have anymore. Thankfully, I'm grateful we don't have it. But it was an interesting experience. I'm glad that I saw it and experienced that period in mental health care. Within the population of inpatient services that I dealt with at that time, we had a substantial number of what were classed as long stay patients. These were people who'd been in hospital for 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years and beyond, people who were admitted for a range of reasons that would never lead to hospital admission now.
Okay.
Commonplace many, many years ago. Women who were defined as moral defectives because they had children out of wedlock. Elderly adults who had learning disabilities who had been placed in an institution as young children. Uh-huh. And in the 70s and 80s was still in hospital when I first met them. And within that population, we had people who had survived the conflict in Europe during the 1940s. Those included British citizens who fought and survived and suffered consequences and had received diagnoses of schizophrenia and similar. We had a number of Eastern Europeans, Poles, Latvians, Ukrainians, Russians, who had been combatants, they'd been civilians caught up in the conflict, and there were also survivors of the Holocaust. We actually had long-stay patients who had tattoos, who had camp tattoos on their arm. They weren't that old. I was 1920 when I first started working in mental health care, and this was 35 years after the conclusion of the war. These people were probably the age I am now, late 50s or even a bit younger. But to me, as a 19-20-year-old, and anyone viewing this will remember being 1920, anyone 30, 40 and above was quite old. And to me, these were elderly people, in part because they were very institutionalized. They had lots of ritualistic behavior associated with being in hospital. They also had lots of ritualistic behavior associated with the trauma of camp life. And they were given labels of schizophrenia. Dementia praecox was one of the diagnoses that was bandied around at the time, learned and disabled, horrible diagnoses of, you know, an idiot, a moron, and such like, which were clinical diagnoses. But no one ever explored whether their mental health problems were actually related to mental illness. And I didn't. I was a young nursing assistant when I first worked in mental health care, and I didn't explore it. They were just patients on long stay wards who we bathed on certain days, issued with clothes and cigarettes, fed at set times, gave medication at set times. We institutionalized them as much as the institution did. Looking back, and I became curious at the time because I was interested in history anyway, but certainly looking back, it's absolutely obvious that these were individuals who had chronic post-traumatic stress disorder. Yeah. There's actually lots of research been done, particularly in Israel, at elderly psychiatric patients who have a primary diagnosis of schizophrenia, where they've withdrawn medication and reassessed them and found that these people who were hallucinating, who were hearing voices, seeing things, hoarding things, screaming out in the middle of the night, paranoid and distrustful, they weren't schizophrenic. They'd got chronic post-traumatic stress problems. Oh. And in hindsight, I look back on that, and I became, as my career progressed, I became absolutely fixated on the impact of trauma on mental health, with certainly with dealing with survivors of adult of childhood sexual abuse. But I look back on these people and think, we let them down. We really didn't endeavour to understand. We merely treated symptoms because that was the culture of psychiatry 37, 38 years ago, more than that now, that it was treat symptoms. People have a diagnosis, you treat the symptoms. You don't explore the symptoms. Today, we would explore it. Yeah, we would explore the reasons why people were the way they were. Certainly, dealing with survivors of genocide since then, and I've encountered survivors from Bosnia, from Rwanda, from Sierra Leone, although it wasn't classified as a genocide, but people have horrible PTSD symptoms, and we appreciate that, we recognise that, and we treat it maybe with medication to alleviate some symptoms, but with a psychological approach, we recognise that these people have been severely impacted by horrendous experiences that most of us can't comprehend.
Yeah.
We can do that with the survivors that I dealt with in 1980-81. So that was part of my interest at the start of it. I'm generally slightly obsessed with history, and particularly about making sure that we learn from history. So I've done public speaking events to Polish societies and others where I freely admit to having been a slightly strange child, that I was reading about genocide when I was 10, 11, because it interested me. I was interested in how the European colonial powers absolutely decimated communities in the countries that they conquered. You know, North and South America, Southern Africa, Australasia. We did, our ancestors did terrible, terrible things, and they would probably rightly be described as genocides, but they weren't at the time. They are more so now. So I was looking into that when I was 10, 11, so I was probably a bit odd. But moving on, I've been fortunate. I've been to Auschwitz a few times and elsewhere in Poland. I've met survivors of the Holocaust. I have some dear friends who are survivors of the Holocaust. I have a close personal friendship with the grandson of the commandant of Auschwitz. So a man who lives with the heritage of his grandfather being responsible for the worst genocide in human history. He tries to make amends for that by challenging hate and the far right today. Been various routes in. One of them actually comes from working in mental health care, and particularly dealing with the offender population. The mental health has always been a Cinderella service, certainly in Britain and probably elsewhere in the world. It's been the most underfunded and misunderstood. People with mental health problems have quite often been demonised. You can think of more derogatory labels for mental illness than you can for any other health condition. People with mental health problems who offend as well are even more demonised. And when, as I have done, you meet thousands and thousands and thousands of people who have been arrested, who have been investigated by the police, who are going through court processes, and they're drug dependent, alcohol dependent, they're socially dysfunctional, they're poorly educated, they tick all the boxes that society would find reasons to disapprove of them. And you look at their background, many, many, many of them actually have quite significant trauma backgrounds created by their experiences. They didn't make a career choice at the age of 5 or 6 or 7 or 14. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to be a drug addict. And I'm going to steal and rob and spend most of my day in prison. I'm not going to worry about food or hygiene or relationships or any of the social norms. My day is going to be doing these things that no one else would consider. It's not a career choice. People fall, by and large, fall into that lifestyle having been created by their life experiences. They're fairly dysfunctional from an early age. You find that a lot of adults who are offenders were struggling at school, they were poorly educated, they were being excluded and expelled, they were in the lower tier of the educational setting. They quite often left school without any qualifications from school. They had experience of the care system, social services involved. They came from broken or unstable home environments. They witnessed domestic violence. They experienced physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual harm. The odds were stacked against them from an early age, and they then become dysfunctional adults. As children, they get sympathy from society. As adults, they don't. So people would question why a child isn't functioning well, isn't adapting well in the same way as other children within the school or other setting. When that dysfunctional child becomes a dysfunctional adult, people cease questioning, they condemn. No one questions why the adult who had a horrible upbringing is so dysfunctional.
Sure. I think that's particularly the case in societies like the UK, where there's perhaps an overemphasis on free will with regards to punishment, that, you know, that, well, it's just your choice, as if you can just flick a switch like that. It's not like you negate the idea of responsibility there, but to me, responsibility is an incremental thing. It's in inverse proportion to the conditions that have affected you. I mean, I think Scandinavian countries seem to have a better approach here. I'm sure they've not got it perfect either. But the level of recidivism, for example, in prisons in Norway is considerably less than in the UK, because they... Well, first of all, they don't take the responsibility away from them. The idea of taking their vote away would be absurd to them, because because then you're just creating this us and them mentality rather than trying to reintegrate those people back into society again.
And it's, when you say about choice, people have to think about the quality of choice. So we all make choices, but sometimes the quality of our choices is limited. I met women particularly, but also men, but primarily women, who were drug dependent and involved in sex work. And people say, oh, well, it's their choice. Well, let's have a think about the quality of that choice.
Yeah.
If their level of drug dependence and financial need is such that other options for getting money aren't available, that they're willing to get into a van with one, two, three, four, five men at a time for £10 a go, that's a poor quality choice, but it might be the only choice that seems available to them. So people are quick to judge.
Yeah.
I would say, the, with offenders particularly, trying to understand how they become an offender doesn't excuse, and I would never seek to excuse. If people do wrong, society and the courts have every right to punish. But if we seek to understand, we can sometimes do something to affect change.
Yeah.
So if someone is drug dependent and they're shoplifting, they're burgling, they're street robbing to fund that habit, understanding the roots into drug dependence, which may be trauma related and maybe multiple other causes, may help to facilitate some regime where they can control and reduce and stop their drug use, which in turn reduces their offending behaviour and the harm they cause. So understanding the roots may actually reduce the harm and benefit society. And people are reluctant to see that quite often.
Sure. Anyway, should we actually have a look at some of the themes you explored in the book? So you draw parallels with the conditions that fueled Nazi Germany's hostility to and treatment of Jewish people, with recent hostility to immigrant and religious minority populations. So what are for you the main similarities, and what are the key differences, and what does this perhaps tell us about recent events and the attitudes that have emerged with them?
I'll do it in a different order to the question, really. The difference is, certainly with Europe, is that we are not Europe in the 1920s.
Okay.
There were multiple factors that made Europe in the 1920s, you know, immediately after the First World War and the years leading up to Hitler's rise to power, that made Europe particularly vulnerable to totalitarian regimes, whether it was in the East in Russia with communism or in Germany and Italy with fascism. But there are similarities in society's susceptibility to the hate and intolerance that those regimes promoted, the willingness to blame the other.
Yeah.
So in general terms, our society, if we look at Britain and look at Europe more generally, and possibly even the United States, there are problems with unemployment and housing and problems associated with austerity and the markets are up and down, the value of the pound or the dollar or the euro is bouncing around, there's poverty and difficulties with the health service and everything else that are probably linked to government policy. They're linked to a number of international factors and policy within given countries, but it's become easy and acceptable to blame it on the other. So in the UK, the inclination over the last couple of years particularly has been to blame it to those across the channel. Taking away the European side of it, there's also been an inclination to blame people within our society, so migrants, refugees, minority groups, that any problems we have in this society are due to them, are caused by them. That's where there is a similarity to the rise of Hitler. Hitler was very willing to blame most of Germany's ills on Jews. The Treaty of Versailles, the surrender, the plummet in Deutschmark, hyperinflation and all the problems associated with that. It was easy to blame the Jews for that. The risks from the Bolsheviks, that was a Jewish thing. Yeah. The threat from the East was Jewish. And German people readily bought into that. I did write about it in the book, where if you look at the research into Germany at the time that Hitler came to power, less than 1% of the German population was Jewish. And most of those Jews were fully assimilated. There were about 580,000 or thereabouts Jews in Germany. Most were fully assimilated and were descended from Jews who'd been in Germany for generations. They weren't discernibly different from anyone else in Germany. They weren't Orthodox. They weren't Hasidic. They weren't standing out as obviously Jewish. There'd been an influx in the early part of the 20th century of about 100,000 Jews from the East, what were referred to as Ostjuden. They stood out because they spoke Yiddish and were Orthodox. But by and large, most Jews in Germany, you wouldn't know they were Jewish. They celebrated Hanukkah and Christmas at the same time. They had mixed marriages. Their children quite often would, Jewish children would marry a Christian and then live as Christians. And most Jews in Germany at the time actually lived in cities. They lived in Berlin, in Munich, in Hamburg, in Dusseldorf, in Stuttgart, in the big cities. Half or just over the population of Germany actually lived away from the cities, lived in the countryside. Therefore, most Germans had probably never met a Jew and had no reason to feel personal animosity to Jews. But Hitler and the Nazi regime sowed this idea that Jews were responsible for all of Germany's ills, and people bought into it. They bought into it because the message was repeated often and consistently, and it wasn't challenged.
Why wasn't it challenged?
People were receptive to it. I think that they needed someone to blame. Germany had been a great European power, and they suffered defeat in the First World War. They'd been hammered financially and politically by the sanctions imposed because of the Treaty of Versailles. They'd lost territory. They'd lost their sense of identity. They wanted someone to blame. It was a difficulty for Germany anyway to accept defeat, to believe that they were beaten militarily when they considered that the war was theirs to win. So it was easier to blame others. And Hitler, with his anti-Semitism and supported by others within the Nazi regime, or Nazi party initially, sowed this idea that the reason Germany was in the state it was in was because of the Jews and because of the Bolsheviks in the East, who were also Jewish. And people bought it. It was a ready and easily digestible message. And we have some similarities today where people buy into the ready and easily digestible messages without questioning them. The sources are different. So in Germany in the 1920s and 30s, there were major rallies, there were newsreels at cinemas, there were radio broadcasts and everything else. Now we have social media, we have mainstream media, certainly with some of the printed press who banner headlines demonising various groups that people accept, because it's in, I won't name the newspapers, but if it's in this paper, it must be true. Social media is a very powerful tool for reinforcing people's belief. People seek almost confirmation bias. I believe this. This message tells me what I believe is true, or it fits in with my narrative of the truth. Therefore, it must be true.
Yeah.
The mediums change, but the messages and the convenience of a message to people's willingness to be intolerant is very similar.
Okay. In the book, you say that social psychologist Marilyn B. Breward, she describes an in-group bias, which presumes that love for that group and hate for the out-group are reciprocally related. Now, rather than reducing this phenomenon, our increasing connectivity can seem as if it makes it worse. What's your take on this view?
Well, she's largely referring to the work of a chap called Allport, who originally looks at in-group and out-group bias. We're willing to accept our own more readily than we are the other. And it's easier, the in-group and out-group, the out-group will be those who aren't part of our group, our tribe, whatever that tribe may be, whether it's people of the same language, ethnic origin, religion, social network, social group. There is an inclination to seek our own and believe our own, and to ostracize one way or another those from outside,
yeah.
Which in some ways, I think I refer to in the book, in some ways a sort of tribalism of in-group can be healthy. It can help with the functioning of society, the way that we look after each other, the way we keep an eye out for each other, the way we care for the sick and the elderly and the young, the way that society almost polices itself. We don't have police on every street corner. We don't have police knocking on doors to make sure people are obeying the laws. We don't have police checking in every shop to make sure that things are being done legally. We tend to police each other, and we police that in part because of our the way we knit together socially as a general in-group. But we're also willing to ostracize those from outside of that in-group who we perceive to be different in another way, usually minority groups.
It used to be a common assumption that increasingly right-wing beliefs resulted in an increase of prejudicial fear of the other, and that left-wing beliefs led to a decrease of such attitudes. These old assumptions seem harder to justify in light of recent events, like anti-Semitism, xenophobia, and even nationalism have become evidence on the left, for example. Has something changed, or were the old assumptions wrong in that those prejudices and attitudes were always there? How useful are labels such as left and right?
Have things changed, or was it all? I suspect there's been elements that there's been a misunderstanding. Certainly the far right, by definition, tend to be fairly nationalistic, and they see the nation state above all others, and they'll perceive threats from outside. But the left wing can be as guilty. Anti-Semitism has rightly had a great deal of publicity, anti-Semitism on the left of the political spectrum. It's always been there. Strangely, in the Soviet Union, anti-Semitism as a political force wasn't supported. There's no real evidence the Soviets per se were anti-Semitic. Russians were anti-Semitic, and there would be ways of making life difficult for Jews within the Russian nation. Pogrom as a word is Russian in origin,
yeah.
Because of the harm caused to Jewish populations there. There is a problem with this convenience or laziness almost of left and right labels. That if we see racism, intolerance, anti-Semitism as being purely an issue of the far right, it can wrap the left in a blanket of smugness.
Yes.
It's them, not us, where the left actually have to say responsibility for anti-Semitism and racism within their own group. We see, and I've referred to it in the book, with some of the populist, far-right, neo-Nazi groups in Europe today, and certainly the right-wing groups in the UK, where they're not traditionally right wing in their support. A lot of their support would be traditional left wing. So some of the groups in Britain, and I'm not going to label any of them, but some of the groups in Britain feed on the insecurities of traditional left wing populations, traditional Labour and socialist supporting populations, who worry about their jobs and their housing and their hospitals and their opportunities and their careers. The far right have drawn them in to their beliefs. Does that make them not a far right party or still far right with left wing people sympathetic? I think there's been a crossover there for a long period of time. We've tended to lazily use labels when labels might not always have necessarily been appropriate. I still think primarily the intolerance that goes with ultranationalism is a far right problem, but there is some crossover with the far left and the hard left.
I get the impression we seem to be making a lot of similar mistakes to societies in the past, i.e. not learning from history. Is this because we create our own others when we think about recent atrocities? That it could never happen to our society, we are sort of different.
Undoubtedly, Germany, as an example, was a flourishing, cultured, affluent, functioning society, and yet it collapsed and all hell was let loose upon Europe. A lot of European societies that came under the umbrella of fascism and the Nazis and bought into their rhetoric were flourishing, healthy societies, but circumstances conspired to make them less flourishing, not least of which was a war and the military might of Nazi Germany. But the collapse was rapid. We can become overly confident in the stability of our own society. These are things that happen elsewhere. They don't affect us. Other people do these things. They won't affect us. Most wars have happened, and certainly civil wars and the horrors that we've witnessed over the last 20, 30, 40 years on our television screens have happened in societies that probably most people think it won't happen here. It'll happen somewhere else, but it's happened there. We need to be aware. We need to be wary. We need to be, when we learn from history, learn the basics, certainly with the risks of genocide, of how the dehumanizing of others can rapidly lead to harm. And we see it with those who flee the war in Syria and elsewhere within that region, people who are willing to take horrendous risks to get to a safe country. And people can argue, well, the Dublin Accord says they should go to the next safe country. I think if you're fleeing and looking for a better opportunity, you're not going to think, oh, well, now we're in Turkey, we're going to stop. Turkey is chocker with refugees. People will probably go to where culturally and linguistically they feel they may be better served. So some, a minority, it has to be said, may make their way to England because they can speak English or they already have relatives who've arrived here. Yeah. So they have some security blanket. Most will go elsewhere, which people don't see. But the fact that people are willing to put themselves and their young children in dinghies that are so unsound to get across the Mediterranean, and they barely get a mention. The drownings that have happened in the Mediterranean over the past decade or so, I think it's 30,000 people that have died in the Mediterranean. It doesn't get a mention. They've become dehumanized. If there was a recent episode, and I wish her well, I'm glad she survived, a woman fell off a liner in the Mediterranean, a British citizen, fell off a liner, and she was found after 24 hours of floating. Thankfully, she was found safe and well. That got major headlines on television news in this country. 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 100 people could drown in the Mediterranean, but because they're refugees, they don't get a mention.
No.
They do get a mention. Sadly, many people wouldn't care. So when we look at learning the lessons of the past, one of the key lessons is we've got to be aware of how quickly we can dehumanize and become desensitized to the suffering of others.
Yeah.
One of the issues with the Holocaust, and you find it with other genocides, isn't just the perpetrators of harm, it's the indifference.
That's it, yes. Yeah,
that people stood by, people saw it was happening, and people didn't care. They didn't necessarily facilitate it actively, but they facilitated it by apathy, by lack of empathy, by lack of sympathy, by lack of concern that dreadful things were happening. And you know, it happened across Europe during the Holocaust. I'm sure it happened in Bosnia, in Rwanda, in Cambodia, in Darfur. I'm sure it has happened elsewhere where dreadful atrocities have been committed against specified social groups and people have turned a blind eye.
I remember when I was younger, hearing in history that those boats carrying refugees from Central Europe, mainly Jews, and how they were turned away from, you know, from the US and the UK, and you thought, wow, how far we've moved on since then. But then, you know, as you say, in the last few years, 30,000 people have died in that's worse, you know, in many ways than what happened then. And you know, that's it's this whole notion of indifference. I mean, I imagine it was the same thing during the time of slavery. You know, it's not that people were out and out racist, perhaps. It's similar, perhaps, to, you know, when you buy T-shirts in shops for £1 now, and you don't do the math, and you think, well, for that T-shirt to be bought for £1, someone must be in a sweatshop, in virtual slave-like conditions, for you to put that T-shirt on your back. But we don't make that connection.
No. I mean, I'm old enough, and you may well be yourself, to remember Biafra.
Yeah.
It was the first time, as a child, I could remember seeing people so hungry that their bellies were distended.
That's it, yeah.
And it made the news in this country, but I can't remember. Admittedly, I was quite young at the time, that there was a huge amount of sympathy. There were some appeals for help. But, you know, as long as I think that the help was directed, as long as it's going over there.
Yeah.
Don't bring the problem here.
Exactly.
And that's been the attitude ever since. That, you know, as long as the problem's over there, it's nothing to do with us. If it's happening to brown people, or people who don't speak English, or people who are culturally very different from us, then it's a problem over there rather than something that we should be concerned about. It's interesting when you look at refugees, and certainly, you know, these are people who are fleeing hell, and none of us in this country really have any concept of the hell of war. Most survivors of the Second World War are few and far between now, so people who can actually remember that. There are many. We've obviously got military veterans, and we've got people in this country who survived conflict elsewhere. But most of us in this country have been safe from the horrors of war for 70 years. We've no real experience of it. We can't comprehend how desperate people must be when their home and their community has been destroyed by war, that they have to flee in the way that they have. And we're equally ready in this country to use the most horrendous terms to describe them. You know, they're plagues, they're swarms, they're vermin, they're cockroaches, which is the language of genocide.
Yeah.
It was found during the Holocaust, it was found during Rwanda, it was found during Bosnia. This dehumanizing language, use animal terms or some other word to take away any sense of humanity about our fellow human beings.
Yeah.
It's horrific to see.
Yeah, and often you make these people, you know, when they're depicted as well, they're often made to look ugly as well, aren't they? And I think they say if you can do those two things, you demonise and make them, then you can kill them, you know, because it's all part of that dehumanising process, isn't it?
Well, certainly, you know, the Holocaust is always a good example because it's the most researched genocide in history.
Yeah.
But, you know, Jews became rats, they became vermin.
Yeah.
It's easy to kill rats and vermin.
Yeah.
You know, you get a pest man in to do that.
Yeah.
And for the Nazis, they were the pest men. You know, during the Hungarian transport to Auschwitz, something like 430,000 people were killed in 56 days. That is an endless stream of humanity going to the gas chambers. The gas chambers could actually cope with the killings, but the crematoria couldn't. When the crematoria couldn't cope, they were throwing people into pits and burning them alive.
Oh.
They had become rats and vermin in their eyes rather than humans. So there were men, women, children, babies, not just being gassed, which is horrendous, but being thrown into pits and burned alive.
Horrific.
Where we see that language today. which is where yes, where lessons being learned. That's where we haven't learned the lesson because people accept that language. People don't question it. There are, I'll use the word star loosely, but there are stars of social media who post horrendous things via Twitter and other media, where they'll describe refugees as cockroaches. They'll talk gleefully the idea of sinking refugee boats in the sea. Have we learned?
It seems crucial that somehow we have to keep these memories alive, and obviously you're playing a part in that, but how else can we do it?
Education is key, I think. We're lucky in this country that we have Holocaust education as part of the curriculum. Where it's provided within schools varied, and not every school provides it, but at least it is on the curriculum in our school. So education about the Holocaust is important, but about other genocides, about the similarities between the Holocaust and other genocides. We need to start with children. We need children to understand. If you meet Holocaust survivors, those who are active in any educational role, they'll invariably say that their favourite audience are children, are teenagers, because the teenagers listen.
Yeah.
When they get middle-aged and older people, they're not interested. They'll sit there, I've heard it all, I'm not interested, I don't need to know it. Young people not only listen, but they ask the most pertinent questions, and they go away and you'll get... I was talking to a survivor friend recently who had just received a huge pile of letters from a school reflecting on their own Holocaust education and her story. And the most wonderful, powerful letters, apparently. She'd really moved by these letters from 14, 15-year-olds.
Fantastic.
So I think they're our starting point. The youth are always the future of a nation.
Yeah, yeah.
Old people are reluctant to learn or reluctant to believe that they need to learn. Whereas we all actually do every day, whether you're working or not. I have the luxury of being retired from nursing, but every day should be a learning day.
Sure, yeah.
Should be learning something new. You should be questioning sources of information. You should be exploring. We have with the internet the greatest library the world has ever had, where you can access not just the slightly dubious content of Wikipedia, which a page can be altered several times a day, but you can access documents, worldwide documents on virtually any subject. So we can explore in ways that 30, 40 years ago we never could. So education's a start, but encouraging people to learn, encouraging people to question, encouraging people to be curious, to be inquisitive, to question those who are providing sources of information, whether it's politicians, whether it's the news, whether it's newspapers, whether it's books, whether it's online. Getting people to be more questioning, I think, is a big part of it. And learning. People should always be learning from the past. Failing to learn from the past condemns us to repeat mistakes.
Sure, yeah. Okay, there seems to be an increasingly popular view that those with prejudicial ideas, particularly if they are extreme, should not be engaged with or debated. To what degree is this an effective way to deal with the issues in question?
It's difficult to sustain. Certainly with the power of social media, if you refuse someone a platform, they'll find a platform. So if I don't agree with someone's worldview, I could refuse to talk to them. They can then share their worldview unchallenged elsewhere. My inclination would be, within reason, we should debate, we should question, we should enter a discussion. I'm not the most politically active person, but I'm not averse to going to the occasional demonstration. And I've been to demonstrations where the people I've been with would probably class themselves as fairly hard left, confronting those who would consider themselves to be hard right or would be perceived as hard right. And the people I've been with have been, don't talk to them. Whatever you do, don't talk to them. I would sooner talk to them, because if we discuss rather than shout, we might actually find a middle ground. We might actually find that some of their fears and anxieties and concerns are understandable. I may not agree with them, but I can understand them.
Yeah.
If we can understand where people's fears come from, we might find a way to address them. Not with everyone. Some people will be very fixed in their worldview. and fairly dogmatic, and reading some of the information about the middle way, that's one of the concerns, is this sort of dogmatic attitude that some people have, whether it's religious, cultural or otherwise. And people are fairly dogmatic, but there are those who are receptive to hearing another view, who, when questioned, might actually question themselves, why do I believe this? You know, if people make a statement that I believe to be patently untrue, you make that statement, where's the evidence to back that up?
Yeah.
That these people constitute that threat? Where's the evidence? I do an exercise, I have done an exercise at a couple of public speaking events. The perception in this country, understandably to a degree, and I don't dismiss harm that's been caused in any way, is that we face some huge existential threat from international terrorism. When you actually look at the figures in this country since the turn of the century, deaths from terrorism, from Islamist terrorism, 126. During the same period, we've had about 12,000 normal murders.
Yeah.
Your routine average murder of domestic violence and everything else is about 12,000.
Yeah.
Compared to 126.
Well, even compared to the 70s, during the time of the troubles in Northern Ireland, the chances of it are extremely slim now, but of dying, you know, from a terrorist act, but considerably less though than even 30, 40 years ago. But you wouldn't think that with what we're told by the media. The thing is, we're talking about biases. We also have a negativity bias. You know, when we're out on the savannah, we're a lot more prone to the idea that there was a bear in that valley, there was some strawberries in that one over there, you know. But that sells newspapers, you know.
Yeah. I do wonder, and I have nothing to back this up at all, but I've pondered how we as a society responded to the troubles in Northern Ireland. And 3,500 people were killed during that period, and many, many more were injured and maimed. And, you know, we had in mainland UK bombs going off. There was, you know, even in rural Shropshire, we had bombs going off. And we were aware of it, and we had the, you know, if you see anything strange, let people know. But part of the reason I wonder why there was less alarm is that those who were reporting it, and indeed the politicians in power at the time, had lived through war.
Right, how interesting.
And were possibly less alarmed by what was going on. And it wasn't minimising the threat. You know, one person harmed, one person killed is one person too many. But I wonder if, you know, our news readers and newspaper publishers and proprietors and editors in the early 1970s would have been reporters in the Second World War or in Korea, and would have seen untold immense horrors. And were they less alarmed by what was going on with the IRA? And, you know, my parents' generation my dad served in the war, but my mum was a civilian who'd encountered her city being bombed.
Yeah.
So were they less alarmed by the occasional threat that we experience from Republicans, primarily in Northern Ireland?
Yeah.
Do we now have a younger generation who haven't experienced the gravity of all-out war, who are more alarmed by it? And we have also a 24-hour news system that has to fill the time. And if an incident occurs, it becomes a loop. You know, a bomb has gone off, a bomb has been found, there's been this incident, there's been that incident, and it will become a loop for 48 hours where people are almost people are traumatised from watching the television screen.
Yeah.
You know, you could be 200 miles away from an incident, but, you know, this endless loop for the 24-hour news channel maybe puts a different slant on it than, you know, twice a day, three times a day, it'll get a mention on the, you know, 1 o'clock news, 6 o'clock news, 10 o'clock news, and that'll be it until you get your paper the next day.
Now, that's an interesting one. I'll reflect on that one, Simon. How concerned are you about the level of prejudice in the world today? And what also perhaps gives you some hope?
I'm concerned about whether we're within westernised societies, Europe, North America, particularly in Australia, whether we're risk of racism and prejudice reaching a level where we're facing the risk of genocide. I have my doubts. It's not to say never, but I don't think we're there, and I think we've got too many safeguards within our political and other systems that would prevent that happening. Plus the education of the populace is greater and the access to alternative sources of information is greater than in previous genocides. So we have a better facility to question the rhetoric of those who would have us do harm.
What about countries like potentially Brazil or the Philippines, where far-right parties have recently come into power?
They're concerned, and you could also say in Europe, in Hungary,
yeah,
we have a far-right government. In Germany, you've got the rise of Alternative for Deutschland. Poland have a fairly hard-right government at the minute. You've got Golden Dawn in Greece,
yeah,
who are avowedly Nazi. They're not anywhere near gaining political power at the minute, but they're a force to be reckoned with. And Brazil probably is, as a good recent example, you had a highly populist nationalist politician who has voiced the most horrendous ideas, you know, anti-gay, quite misogynistic, quite disparaging about others, quite racist. And people have bought into his rhetoric, despite having the access to social media and the sources that facilitate a more questioning society. So they serve as a warning. So I would never say never, but I'm hoping the safeguards in place. That having been said, the safeguards are fragile. It doesn't take much to cross the Rubicon into something more horrendous. A few straws can break the camel's back of tolerance and stability. It doesn't take a huge amount. It takes, you know, mass unemployment, financial crash, civil unrest, breakdown of law and order for whatever reason, instability in government where no one appears to be in control or government lose control completely and others move in to fill the void. So that can happen in any society. I think by and large we have the checks and balances in place to try and control that. The United States is a good example where Trump isn't everyone's cup of tea, isn't my cup of tea. And some of the things he says and some of the ideas he puts forth are certainly alarming. And that's me trying to be polite about him. But the checks and balances in the United States seem to be reining him in. Their electoral system and the power of the Senate and Congress seems to be controlling things. And he's only there for a fixed term. He may get elected for a second term, but maximum he'll have two terms. What happens subsequent to him remains to be seen. But the checks and balances seem to be holding things fairly tight. I would hope the same applies here. We're at an unstable period in British history at the minute with a lot of uncertainty. But the checks and balances are just about holding together. It wouldn't take much to tip it over, though. And I think we've got to be aware of that.
Yeah. What's your understanding of the middle way and how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
I haven't read a huge amount, but one of the actual middle way, the words middle way are the bit that struck me of trying to find that balance between sort of dogma and rigid thinking, whether it's political, cultural, religiously or societally influenced. That's the bit that's standing out for me as a concept of the middle way.
Right. OK, well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today, Simon, and I'll continue to follow your work with interest.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.